Thank you, Dr. Stiff. My father, who sits on the dais behind me, reminded me shortly before the banquet of what former Chief of Staff Donald Regan told President Regan during one of his last speeches. Keep it short. But it was very difficult to look through the biographical summary of Dr. Edelman and isolate things that I felt you should know, because everything here is a real accomplishment. So I'm going to have to read them very, very quickly. I'm going to have to do it at announcer speed, so listen closely. Marion Wright Edelman has been active in civil rights and public interest affairs since her graduation from Yale Law School in 1963. She started and directed the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund office in Jackson, Mississippi from 1964 to 1968, and was the first black woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar. In 1968, Mrs. Edelman founded the Washington Research Project, which became the Children's Defense Fund in 1973, and has served as director since its inception. CDF, as it's called, has been active in a wide range of children and family issues. It has published numerous reports on children out of school and without health care, and on child welfare and adoption. CDF has been a leader in defending and expanding the rights of children through the courts, blocking the placement of Louisiana children in out-of-state Texas institutions, quarantining special education rights to thousands of children in Mississippi, and in representing systematically the interests of children and families before federal administrative agencies. In addition, CDF has actively promoted the need for expanded quality child care. Mrs. Edelman was born in Bennettsville, South Carolina, and attended Spelman College, where she now chairs. Please, please, we don't have the time. Attended Spelman College, where she now chairs the Board of Trustees. She is married to Peter Edelman, an attorney, and the Edelmans have three sons. Among the numerous other activities, Mrs. Edelman was the first black woman elected to the Yale University Corporation. And her present board memberships include the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, the Aetna Life and Casualty Foundation, the Atari Institute, and Essence Magazine. She is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She was named by Time Magazine in 1971 as one of America's 200 young leaders, and by the Ladies' Home Journal in 1983 as one of the 100 most influential women in America. In 1985, she became a MacArthur Foundation Prize Fellow. Brothers and sisters, after the selection, we are very, very proud to present to you Dr. Marion Wright Edelman.
As a non-clergy and a non-man and a non-Methodist, I know how blessed I am to be here tonight. I thank you. It is nice to be in such distinguished company with the City Council Chair and my Spelman sister, who is presiding over this evening, and with all these distinguished leaders who are so important to the well-being of children and families, and to Carolyn Anderson, who's been so helpful in helping us at the Children's Defense Fund and our agenda. And I thank you for that gracious introduction. The last Reverend Williams in a row of Reverend Williamses. But it's lovely to be here. It's also just a great pleasure to get introduced and to have a hum come out of the audience when somebody says Bennettsville. And if there's people here who know about Bennettsville, y'all is good folks. I spend my life explaining where Bennettsville is to people. And it's nice to be with people who know. I even have see someone in the audience, Bishop Thomas, who even knew my daddy, and that just makes me feel, who was a Baptist minister, makes me feel right at home. So thank you for having me come and share in your celebration. Also glad to be here because black children and black families need you now more than ever. I think the black community faces the worst crisis we have faced since slavery. We have fought all the external enemies, slavery. We've gone through Jim Crow, resegregation. And here we are finding ourselves threatened again from within with the disintegration of our families and the loss of our children. And we can't save our children unless the church get involved. You've got the networks, you've got the outreach capacities. Hope you got the values. But the church has to be, once again, the arms and hands and feet and voice of compassion that Christ was about to our children, too many of whom are not in the church. And the church is going to have to go out into these housing projects and out into the street and bring them into the churches, and you're going to have to do a better job with the children who are in your churches if we're going to save our young people. So I'm glad to be here because we need you desperately. I'm going to give a longer version of Superintendent Wilson's speech. And let's just get going because I'm going to spend most of the evening talking about the black family and about teenage pregnancy and what we're all going to have to do as people of God and religious people to recapture our children's values and to recapture our families. And you know, it's not just doing good for those people, for those children. It is the very future of the black community that's at stake. We have struggled 200, 300 years for the vote and to begin to get opportunity and for political power, and I'm not trying to be elitist by any means, but if we project 20 years down the road to the kinds of poor families that are beginning to become the majority in our next generation that are going to nurture the majority foundation of our generations, and say, who are going to be the voters? Who are going to be the political leaders? Where is this political organization that's going to protect all of us? I think we'll find that we all have something at stake in saving the least among us, because the top cannot rise without the bottom. And we have got to build bridges back from the middle class to the poor, because we are all one family, and we're going to sink together or we're going to rise together. Let's talk about black children. 6 out of 10 black infants born today are born to single mothers out of wedlock. 4 out of 10 of these single mothers are teenagers. Black baby today has almost a 1 in 2 chance of being born poor. Black infant born in the inner city of Boston and most of our inner cities has less of a chance of reaching the first year of life in some of those inner city neighborhoods than a baby born in Costa Rica. Black babies still die at twice the rate of white babies. Male unemployment within the black community and the steadily decreasing black male-female ratio are important contributing factors to the steadily increasing number of black families headed by females. In 1980, for the first time, there were more black children who lived with one parent than lived with both parents. Because the proportion of black families headed by single females is so large, the economic consequences represent a crisis in the black community. It is accurate to say that a child growing up in a household headed by one parent has less of an opportunity too often to achieve a full and productive life. It's not because those single parents are not good parents. They love their kids, many of them, as much as any other folk. But it's just harder trying to raise children by yourself. And many single parents give all they can, but they need support from the rest of the community. And again, that's where the church has got to become that extended family, and all of us have to become that extended family to see those children get everything that they need. If the current trend continues, by 1990, 56% of our families are going to be headed by single females. And again, these women, like most women or the average woman in American society, cannot often earn enough money to pull themselves out of poverty. CDF, we're deeply concerned with child and family poverty, and because of that, we are deeply concerned with adolescent pregnancy. Because the young is hard enough for older female mothers to make a decent wage, they don't, most of them. But when we look at female-headed households where the mother is 25 and under, 86% of them are poor. And again, that's related to what Dr. Wilson was talking about, school dropouts. I mean, if you drop out or you have a baby in ninth or 10th grade, you drop out. In this society, there's just no way you're going to be able to make it. And if you have a second baby within 2 years, as 30% of our young people do, you're really almost down the path to welfare dependency. That's why we are focusing in on preventing teen pregnancy as the one place we can intervene to try to see if we can affect two generations of children. We have to bear in mind, when I talk about teen pregnancy, I'm talking about prevention, but for those mothers who are already mothers at 15, 16, we've got to figure out what we're going to do for them to keep them on their feet, to keep them back, getting back in school, to make sure that they go on and get as much training and opportunity as they can, but you got to figure out what you're going to do with that baby as well. And something that worries me very much is how much younger the age is now becoming. More and more of our young people, we have 150,000 girls every year in America, black and white, who are pregnant, of which about 30,000 give birth. I had a call from a friend in Chicago, though, that really showed me how the cycle was beginning to get younger and younger, and on both generations. They told me about a 12-year-old who just had a baby, but what was unusual about that, we have 12-year-olds who have babies every year, but what was unusual is that the grandmother was 24 years old. And so we're beginning to see, again, a squashing that we're all going to have to focus on. That's why, as Dr. Wilson said, we can no longer not talk about it. And that's why the cornerstone of our efforts at the Children's Defense Fund is to prevent teen pregnancy, and it is to provide positive life options for every child. Because if we don't give our children a solid basic skills foundation, solid values foundation, jobs, opportunities to feel useful and to be engaged in constructive activity, to have adult role models that communicate positive values, hope, and a vision of a future worth protecting, as well as family life education, we're not going to prevent but merely delay the formation of poor families. And my goal is not to have 22-year-old welfare-dependent dropout mothers, but to make sure that every mother who's raising black children in the next generations is able to have the skills that she needs to raise a healthy and educated group of our next future of young people. So I want to talk tonight about the compelling reasons, moral reasons, human reasons, economic and self-interest reasons, why every one of us has got to care and work to prevent premature teen sexual activity and pregnancy. The first reason we've all got to prevent teen pregnancy, and it's the message I give to the white folk as well, more so, is that it affects everybody's family, everybody's community, everybody's neighborhood and region. It's not just a poor black problem. It's not our middle-class black kids are getting pregnant too. Our middle-class white kids are getting pregnant too, and there are more white pregnancies every year than black pregnancies, and I certainly do like to remind white people of that. Of the almost 500,000 teen girls who had babies in 1984, an overwhelming majority, almost 330,000, were white. The black community at least knows it has a disproportionate problem, and our girls are much more likely to get pregnant, much more likely to have their babies, and much more likely to be poor and to stay poor than white girls, so the consequence is different. So we've got to focus on it as a black community, but one way in which we get the nation to focus on it is by convincing them as well that it is their problem, and it is their problem. The white family patterns are where the black family patterns were 20 years ago, but we've got a worse problem, and we've got to take the leadership in solving our own problem. The second reason we really do have to be concerned about teen pregnancy is because it is a very significant factor in the high numbers of low birth weight babies, which increase the likelihood of birth defects in our community and among any community. Only about half of our teen mothers obtain cost-effective prenatal care. And that just increases the likelihood of poor health outcomes, and those babies who are being born to young mothers who are disproportionately poor have enough strikes against them in the first place. They don't need to end up with low birth weights and therefore at greater risk of birth defects. Our country does very badly on getting mothers in for prenatal care, and I want to see some sermons out of these pulpits to our congregations about the absolute importance of getting early and good health care for all poor mothers, because black women are not going in for good care, and they need it if black babies are going to be born healthy, because babies who are born at low birth weight are much more likely to die in the first year of life, but teens are less likely to admit that they are pregnant, therefore they're less likely to come in. Our health care system does not do a good job in outreaching to them or in providing the kinds of services that they feel comfortable in receiving. So again, when we begin to tackle teen pregnancy, we can hopefully begin to tackle low birth weight babies, which place our babies at risk, which gets into the third reason why we really do have to work together to prevent teen pregnancies, because of its relationship to shamefully high infant mortality rates. Our babies are dying at absolutely unacceptable rates, again, in part because of the absence of prenatal care, because of poverty. And I'm going to also get to the fourth reason, because the early sexual activity and the early pregnancy also puts our young people at greater risk of sexually transmitted diseases, and we're going to have to talk about that in the churches too. I never thought I'd see a day. I didn't know about an infection named chlamydia until I got involved in teen pregnancy, but an estimated 1 million teens suffer from chlamydial infections each year. Chlamydia is the most common cause of infant pneumonia, and pneumonia is a leading cause of infant death. Sexual transmitted diseases, in addition to chlamydia, also threaten the well-being of our teens and of their babies. We've had a dramatic increase in the number of reported cases for syphilis in individuals among teenage girls, and teens who are sexually active are much greater likelihood, or they're the highest risk group for sexually transmitted diseases of any in our population. And now, not only do we face syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia, we have this thing called AIDS. 6 out of 10 children with AIDS are black. By 1990, the Centers for Disease Control estimates that more than 3,000 cases of AIDS will have been diagnosed in infants and in children, and our minority children are at disproportionate risk. All of us have got to begin to talk and communicate and face up to these issues with our young people, because AIDS is lethal, and we cannot let our silence not help us sit down and tell our young people about the consequences of premature sexual activity, so that they can know, because young people don't think through all the consequences of their actions, and we as adults have an obligation, it seems to me, to begin to communicate with them about all the effects of these decisions at early ages. I applaud Surgeon General Koop's recent call for sex education as a measure to prevent AIDS. I think AIDS may well bring us to our senses about our young in a way in which a million pregnancies every year hasn't. So maybe the Lord is moving in mysterious ways to converge a lot of concerns to get us to communicate with our young people. It's long overdue. The fifth reason why we've got to work to prevent teen pregnancy is because teen pregnancy contributes to large numbers of abortions, and our young people are often using abortion as a contraceptive. And we can see young people coming into clinics who've had 2 and 3 abortions. Nobody should be having abortions at 14, 15, 16. And the best way to begin to prevent both pregnancies, abortions and births, it seems to me, is for all of us to begin to find earlier ways to communicate with our young people so that they don't have to face these consequences. We have got to deal in our churches and in our families with this serious problem when our kids are young and before they make these mistakes. The next reason we have got to focus in on preventing teen pregnancy is because of its relationship to school dropouts and to education. Teen pregnancy is the single largest reason in parenthood, or the single largest reasons why our girls drop out of school. About 40,000 girls drop out of school every year because of pregnancy, and many of them drop out as early as the 9th grade. What we're now learning because of new research by Professor Sum out at Northeast is how critically important basic skills, which is what Dr. Wilson was saying, is, though, to the prevention of pregnancy, and how critically important education is. You know, one of the messages we're trying to take all over the country now is that preventing teen pregnancy is not primarily a contraceptive issue. That's not what we're about. It's an opportunity issue. It's about hope. Young people who think they're going someplace, who have a future, who have something that they think is not worth, they don't want to lose, are going to try to be responsible and try to prevent pregnancy. But young people who are doing badly in school, who don't have an adult or family support system, who don't feel that there's a job out there or feel that there's something worth waiting for, that they're going to be no better off at 21 than they are at 16, tend not to work to prevent these things from happening. But the basic skills data is just very important, and the message we've got to take to all of our schools is the single most important thing you can do to prevent pregnancy is to teach kids to learn to read and write and compute so that they can feel competent and feel they're on a ladder of opportunity. Young people who by 18 have the weakest reading and math skills compared to those with above average basic skills are 8 times more likely to bear children out of wedlock, 7 times more likely to drop out of school, 4 times more likely to be out of work, and 4 times more likely to turn to welfare. Schooling, keeping young people learning, is critically important if we're going to have any success in preventing teen pregnancy and in having young people grow up with the skills they're going to need to prevent this blight. The last reason why I think we've all got to be concerned is because, again, we've got to think about the 2 generations of our children, the babies of the babies. And we've got to begin to intervene in this cycle because we now know that teen pregnancy has a strong relationship to long-term welfare dependency. And again, that goes back to the relationship between teen pregnancy and the fact that these young mothers often leave school before they've been able to get out of school and get the skills that allow them to get a job. And because the consequences for teen pregnancy now are very different. All of us growing up in our communities knew young women who had babies when they were teens. But we had a community setting, the church, that girl and her baby were back in church after the birth the next Sunday morning. The grandmom was there. The church held out its hands and welcomed them then there. The mother went on back to school. Or if they made a mistake, the young man and the young woman could get married, and the young man could go on the farm and make a living or go off to the army. The young man can't go on the farm and support a family anymore, and he often can't get in the army because he's dropped out too. And so that you don't have the economic base for forming healthy, sustained families now because of the way the economy in America has changed. And so it's a different world, and the consequences are different. I want to talk very briefly about what gets in our way of solving and what are the things we're going to have to overcome. The first barrier is, again, our inability to talk about it. You know, we've been keeping it a secret, thinking it's going to go away. Well, a million pregnancies means it's not going away. And when we have 60% now of our babies being born to never married mothers, it's time for us to talk about it and to try to help our young people be aware of the consequences, because it is now threatening the very strength of the black family. The second barrier that gets in the way is that everybody wants to look for the answer or the strategy, and they want it all to happen in 60 minutes without any real cost to us all and without any real sacrifice to us all. Teen pregnancy is very complicated. In many ways, we're going to have to change lots of things, and we can't just do one thing, and it's going to take all of us working in concert together to get a hold of this problem. The other thing that's important, and we've been saying to folks, is that teen pregnancy is not a single problem. We're going to have to develop different kinds of approaches to different groups of young people. In the black community, it's not that we're having more babies. That's the problem. Bill Moyes' show that you saw made it think that all black women are going around having more and more babies. We're not having more babies. The problem in the black community is we're having fewer babies, in fact, but we're not getting married. And we're not getting married because black men don't have jobs, and black men without jobs can't support families. And so the base of the black family crisis is the inability of the black man to get a foothold in the economy. And we're going to have to deal with the employment base of the black man. The white community has a problem that's different. They are having more babies, and they are having them out of wedlock, and they're having more of them as teens. So that, again, we've been trying to get people to say we've all got a similar problem, but they're not for the same reasons, and they're not with the same consequences, but our problem is the problems of economics and of value. The third barrier that gets in our way is that we have let, and it's our fault, I believe, in the black church and the black community, we have let the progress that we need to make in talking to our young people when we can't do it in our families or to get family life education in the schools, even though the majority of the American people support family life education, we have let the right wing goth church come in and obstruct, you know, the information that our children need, and we have not provided a counter voice. And as a result, not only are we not supporting good policies of when a Superintendent Wilson tries to come in and do the right things, he needs the support from all of us, whether it's clinics in or out of schools. We need to be clear about the facts, and often we're not clear about the facts, and we have an obligation to go and talk to our leaders who are struggling to do these things in the best way they know how, and nobody has the right answers, but we need to struggle together as a community, trusting each other, trying to find solutions. But we don't need to be hooking up with the right-wing people like Phyllis Schlafly and all the right-wing ministers attacking things that poor folk are trying to get done in schools to help our children, so at least we can get informed. And if we don't like the solutions that are being proposed, let's come up with other solutions. Everybody wants to tear down. Nobody wants to build. And the point is, we've got to find answers because we've got to save our kids. And if you've got better ideas, terrific, let's transmit them. If you don't like what the schools are doing, let the churches show them what they can do in the churches. But let's have a lot of competition to get around to reaching our children and seeing that they get what they need. Last thing I want to talk about as being a big barrier is the fact that we've let teen pregnancy be viewed as a woman's problem and not as a man's problem. It takes two to form a good family. It takes two to have a baby. And we got to start stop telling our girls to be chaste and telling our boys to score. We are raising our sons. We are raising our sons to exploit our daughters. I mean, we really need to sit down and provide values lessons for both of them about the responsibilities of families so that they can have a context and a framework from us so that they will know what their responsibilities are as fathers and as mothers. The church needs to grapple with how we can provide a rite of passage for our young people and to give them new notions of what being a man is and what being a woman is, so that they learn from us as our forefathers in the African tribes told them they went through rituals about manhood and womanhood. We need to begin to define for our young people through our churches what these things mean so that they can become responsible adults, and we need to reinforce that through our own example. The last big barrier that I want to talk about is our hypocrisy as adults, our double standards, and our confused values. Our children do what we do, not what we say. Two-thirds of all out-of-wedlock births today in both the white and the black community are not to teenagers, they are to adult women, okay? We're asking our young people to be different from everything that they see in their communities. So we have got to teach them by what we are. Our families and our churches counsel our children to say no to sex, while our television and our movies and our advertisers say yes, yes, yes to sex. And we ought not to be buying Calvin Klein jeans, folk. They are using sex to sell jeans. And they're sending messages to our young people that sex is bliss without consequence, and yet we reward them with our patronage. We don't take the time to write letters to the networks to say we didn't like that, or to send letters to the networks when we do like what they're doing and trying to bring about more responsible programming. If I ever see Madonna in a dark alley, I'm going to trip her up. But we are rewarding Madonna by buying her records and making them bestsellers, or not at least. You can't keep our kids from using their money to buy the records, but we can sit down and talk with them about, if I were you, why I wouldn't do that. In the same way in which we need to sit down and talk with them about how to understand the television they're looking at or the movies that they're looking at, we need to become re-involved in our children's lives and to begin to grapple with them. I am so grateful to my mother and father. You know, we grew up in a small, segregated town where things were tough, with all the outside world told black kids back in the 50s that we weren't worth much. But our family said it wasn't so. Our churches said it wasn't so. Our school teachers, who were not most educated in the world, but they loved us and they knew who we were and they cared about us and they reported on us, said it wasn't so. And we knew that being poor, and we knew that being poor was no excuse not to succeed. And when I look back about the people who were most important to me, they weren't the educated people. It was the ordinary folk in the church congregation who took time with children. We felt so important. We were so busy in the church. When we couldn't go to the white children's playground, my daddy started a playground behind the church. So we would have a place to go play. You know, we couldn't go to the public library. We had books in our church where we could read, and parents read with us, and they reinforced the importance of reading. We were told that we were put on this earth to serve, and the adults served with us and were an example about what life is about. And the message that came through, not only did you have to get educated, you got to give it back. And we did it because they did it, and they did it with us. Where are the adult voices today that are offering counter messages to what our young people get on TV? Where are the counter voices to the drug dealers and to the pimps? Where are our voices in the churches? How are we going to work to recapture our children? The other thing I remember most, too, was just how busy we got kept again, because you can't, teen pregnancy prevention is not like telling kids not to smoke. You got to put something better in place. And my dad, I used to get so mad at him. He used to spend so much, we couldn't sit down for 2 minutes and just relax. I mean, he always had something for us to do. Can't you find something constructive to do? And I just won, but the whole thing of recreation, I just want to emphasize being so important and why we got to open up these schools before school and after school and on weekends in the summer and how these churches got to be opened up. I just had some friends in Louisiana who told me they figured out they could just buy a VCR in this rural town where the movie had closed down so kids could come in there and just look at a movie on a Friday night. Kids need to be off the street. They need to have you thinking about ways in which they can be constructively engaged. I listened to a chilling tape, Debbie, a couple of months ago by an interviewer with a young man on New York streets who just killed an old lady. And he described in great detail how he'd gone about attacking her in the street and snatching her purse. And the interviewer asked her why he did it. And he said, I didn't have nothing better to do. And I think that's a terrible indictment of the adult community when our young people constantly, it's what I hear a lot, we don't have nothing better to do. The first thing we're going to have to figure out in our churches and as black adults is how do we find something better for our children to do? How can we begin to look at our church programming so that it's an enticing place for young people to be? How can we set up communication processes and groups so that we can begin to talk with them and listen to them and hear them? And some churches are beginning to do that gradually. 5 years ago, when I said sex, the churches said, you talk to somebody else about that. Who should be talking to them? It is not us. Why should we leave them to get their messages on family values from the streets and from each other and from the television set? The parents should be talking, but parents don't know how to talk to their children often. Our parents didn't talk to us, so we don't know how to talk to them. One of the things churches can begin to do is to hold family life and human sexuality workshops for families, for parents. There was one New Orleans church that took folk awake for a week, the grandparents, the parents, and the kids, to talk about family life and sex education. Very important, and I hope you can begin within your Christian context to help parents learn how to communicate effectively with their young people and to begin to think about ways in which you, secondly, can begin to program and reach out to young people, whether it's in movies or in after-school programs or in tutoring. There cannot be enough role model programs or mentoring programs. There are so many children who don't have a single consistent adult in their lives. And where they don't have fathers, we have to be the fathers. You have to be the fathers. The Big Brothers programs, the mentoring programs are terribly important. I've left here, you will get tomorrow, there's a little purple booklet on what one church can do to prevent teen pregnancy, and there's an example. In it are about 10 examples of what black churches already are doing around the country to prevent teen pregnancy. And one of the things that I'm so pleased about are the number of male enhancement programs and the male modeling programs. Secondly, young people just need to have a sense of what they can be. And so all of us who run businesses or know people in the community who are doing things constructive, they just need to take the time to involve a child in that so that they can begin to get a sense of what they can be, because often if you live in a housing project and there are not a lot of people around who are doing constructive things, you don't see how your life can be any different. Just pull them out and begin to reach out and show them black folk doing constructive things and give them a sense of hope. What they need most is hope and a little help up the ladder. Third, I do hope we can begin to provide a lot more outreach and to get outside of our churches and to bring a lot of those poor youngsters who are not in our churches into those churches by responding to their needs. Sam Proctor down at Abyssinia's got a football team with fancy uniforms, and none of those football kids are in Abyssinia Church, but they may be there one day. We need to figure out how we can use our church resources to help all those young folk who don't have the advantage of parents who bring them to church on Sunday morning, and maybe that's a way in which we will prevent our sagging membership from sagging over the next 10 and 20 years. You can go out in the pastures and bring in new sheep. The last thing I really want to ask you to do is to join us, though, because while we have got to do more on a one-on-one basis, and I think each of us needs to just think hard about how we can tithe our personal time and our personal energy in relating to individual children and individual families in our community. Secondly, I think we've got to figure out how we can use our church plants as a way of bringing in and providing support services to families of all kinds, to single families, to teenage families, to boys, to girls, to communicate, to involve them constructively. Third, I also wanted to get with one of the things we need to do, too, is to give our young people some rootedness and who we are as a community and in our history, because they're not getting enough of it in their schools, and young people who don't know where they came from are not going to go anywhere. I mean, I'm sure those of you up here at Harvard, I have met a lot of these really smart young people at Harvard. It is shocking to know how many of them never heard of Dr. Mays or never heard of many of the most prominent black leaders on whose shoulders they stand. And again, that's because we're not teaching them. And we can't get it from the public schools. The churches have got to instill in these young people another sense of pride so they know that they have a tradition to uphold, just as we must know we have a tradition to uphold. Finally, we can't do it all ourselves, and we're going to have to be active in speaking out for black kids in the public policy arena. There's a lot we can do ourselves in providing leadership, but we can't create all the jobs black men need to form healthy families. We can't create all the summer jobs. We can create some that black young people need to stay off the street. We can't provide all the health care but all the uninsured need and the disproportionate number of them that are black. So we've got to force the Congress and the state legislature and our city councils and all of our public officials to begin to treat black poor folk in a fair manner and to provide them the opportunities that government has always provided for middle class and white people. And that means I hope we can plug you in and that we can communicate more effectively, and we've been doing it very well. I must say that the Methodists are far ahead of the Baptists, and you all have been absolutely terrific in responding on the legislative side. But we are gonna, Mr. Reagan's almost gone, and we're gonna have a new period of real opportunity and attention to the needs of families and children. And I want to make sure that we maximize that harvest for our poor kids, that we really get the education funding, the Head Start funding that now reaches only 17% of the eligible, that we really get that health care. If you would be willing to consider doing one letter offering a year on a key legislative issue, it would make such a difference. And secondly, we annually say how every senator and how every congressman votes on children and the poor. I hope that we can share this voting record with you, and if your congressman and senator is not voting 70% to 80% on this voting record, you're not doing your job. 50 letters, 100 letters makes an enormous difference, but I really do hope that you will become a real voice for justice for children in the public policy arena, showing through your own example what you're doing, what government also ought to do. And that we can do with you in a much shorter time than we can do without you. You have such power. I want to sit down with just two last things. It's not, we're facing a bleak time, but you have such power in your hands. You have such a capacity to make a difference. The timing is so ripe, and I'm just so grateful to have you as an audience tonight. I look back at one of my role models, and I tell this story a lot since Dr. Wilson also took my closing quote from Dr. Mays, so I'm going to have to switch on quotes. That's terrific. But Sojourner Truth is my role model, and I quote her a lot, and I think it has a message for us all. Because she was a woman who didn't know how to read and write, but she had an absolute commitment to justice, to first-class treatment of women, and she fought against slavery all of her life. And my favorite Sojourner story came one day when she was preaching out against slavery, and an old white man stood up in the audience and heckled her and told her he didn't care any more about what she was talking about than an old flea bite. And she snapped back at him and said, "That's all right, Lord willing, I'm going to keep you scratching." Everybody likes to be a leader. I like for all of us to think about being a part of a massive flea corps for children. Enough fleas biting strategically can make even the biggest dog uncomfortable. And if we had fleas in every black Methodist congregation, Lord, we could cause a revolution in this country. So I really want to ask you to join me in being a flea for children over the next decade. Each church decided they were going to get one black kid adopted. We wouldn't have black kids in foster care. You know, set some goals. If each black church set up tutoring for black children, we'd begin to see a difference in black skills level. If each black church committed itself to scholarships for black young people, we'd begin to reverse this trend of fewer young people going on to college. You know, if each black middle-class doctor committed to taking some Medicaid patients, we wouldn't have the provider system, the problems that we've got. We have got to build bridges back from the middle class to the poor and reestablish a sense of black community, or we're not going to survive. And that has got to start in the churches. We've got to teach our young people that we care by caring. We've got to teach them the work ethic. They want to come get a job and make as much as I make the first year. You've got to teach them how to work up the ladder. You've got to teach them how to pay the dues. You've got to teach them discipline, but you've got to show them that discipline. You have got to train our young people again. That takes time. That takes effort. But if you don't do it, who's going to do it? I'll sit down with Charles Wesley. He said, do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. And if you do that, the Lord's going to bless us, and he will. Thank you.